DJ PK and Dave Rose joining us. The former BYU basketball head coach is on the Sprint special guest line. Sprint makes it safe and easy to get what you need online. Please visit Sprint.com for online services and local store availability. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing, guys?
We're doing well. I got a bunch of topics to talk to you about, but one I want to get started with, you know, I've not only watched The Last Dance, but then I've watched people talk about The Last Dance the last couple days, and I always talk about how, you know, someone who's 25 years old would have been three when Jordan hit the shot, right, to beat the Jazz in 98 and win the sixth title. So they watched The Last Dance and really learned a lot about Jordan. And I wondered if people like you, who made a living in the game, but, you know, you had to recruit and run a program and hire assistants and deal with whatever craziness happened in the off season, and, like, how much did you miss of the NBA in that era? Because, you know, you were working. You had your own team. And if you watched The Last Dance, how much did it fill in for you? And how much did you get kind of, you know, by osmosis? And you already knew.
Well, I mean, you know, the great thing about it was that you watched it all, okay, and you remember it. You remember the, you know, the 63 that he got at the Garden. You know, I mean, all the highlights of his career that they showed in that Last Dance. You remember watching it, but it was all the backstories to it that were so interesting to me. I mean, because obviously I wasn't three when right. that was going on. I was, you know, in my mid-40s probably, maybe. And so I obviously as a spectator just idolized Michael and what he could do and how he did it. And then living here in Utah and watching him do it to our Jazz at the best point in the franchise's history, you know, with Carl and John, and it was just amazing. Probably my favorite part of the whole documentary was season 7, the last 10 minutes or so of that, when other players were trying to show the respect that he deserves because he is the greatest of all time and played with them, been around him, but then tried to tell the truth about what it was really like to be around him and how he pushed people and made this game about one thing, period, and that was winning championships and what he had to do to make that happen. And they end it with him getting kind of emotional because, he realizes that, he probably lost a few friends and made a lot of enemies with his pursuit of trying to be the greatest champion of all time.
Now, you played with a couple of great players in Olajuwon and Drexler, and you coached some very good players, obviously. Do you see anything that is common amongst those people?
Well, I joke with those two guys all the time. Clyde and Hakeem, it's a good thing Michael went to play baseball or they wouldn't have a ring themselves because the dude may have won 8 in a row, you know. But the one thing, Clyde reminds me a little bit of Michael, and it was funny to watch Michael kind of talk about Clyde in what I felt was maybe a little bit of a disrespectful way. That he
For
was
sure.
nowhere close to the level that he was. And, you know, it's funny because my wife's watching it with me and she's just going, man, how can a guy say stuff like that? And to me, that was the beauty of the whole episode. He was really honest. He told from his heart what he felt about Gary Payton and, I mean, just some of the guys who he played against. And, but Clyde was a guy who he kind of just really kind of concerned himself with his game and then us winning games, that's probably a similar comparison to what I watched with Jordan.
So Jordan just came across as so incredibly ruthless. Are other elite players, you know, 80% of that ruthless? Is that part of being it, or is that really something to Jordan that makes him different and makes him stand out from other elite players?
Well, I don't know. I just don't know if today's player would put up with a guy like that. And it's just a different time. It's a different era. Kids are brought up differently as far as, the best player in California and the best player in New York, they've known each other since they were, 12, 13 years old. They've played against each other in tournaments all over the country. They're a lot more friendly to each other. They know each other better. I think that, you take LeBron's run through the NBA is so much different than Michael's run through the NBA. And obviously he's been really successful and won himself championships at different franchises. But, I mean, for what Michael did at that time with that franchise, I mean, it was a franchise that was awful. They were just a group of guys fielding a team to compete against in the NBA, and he took that group and made it one of the best dynasties in the history of sport of any kind worldwide.
Talk about how players are different today. We've spoken about this now in retrospect since you're out, but still have the knowledge of the game, and that's as far as players transferring. You look at a program like up at Utah, it's got another kid who's going to transfer here who was in the rotation, most likely would have been in the rotation. They're trying to build something, and they take a couple of steps back and one step forward type of thing with these transfers. Anything can be done to slow this?
Well, it's so hard, and tomorrow is a huge day in the whole transfer because there's a vote. They're going to vote to see if every player in the NCAA gets one free transfer. It's like a mulligan in golf. I mean, you get the first one, you get a chance to transfer without having to sit out a year. And everyone thinks, the majority of people think it's not going to pass, but it's going to a vote. And when it goes to a vote, you never know what's going to happen. On Wednesday morning, there could be thousands of kids that want to, try somewhere else because they don't have to sit out for a year. So we'll see. That'll be a big deal because a lot of kids obviously, don't want to spend a year, without playing competitively with the season. And so that won't slow it down, that's for sure. Slowing it down will be the vote against that a little bit. But I don't think that it's so hard because, everybody is so focused on themselves first, the team second. And that's all I really tried to do in the whole 36 years that I was coaching, was trying to make guys put the team first and then themselves second. And then the success of the team would bring them all of what they wanted, their personal goals, because that's how it worked in my life. I mean, I was a good high school player and got a chance to play junior college and then ended up at one of the best teams in the history of collegiate basketball. We went on 26 games in a row. We were ranked number one for 8 or 9 weeks in a row and played for the national championship. And that success of that team helped me in my career since the day we lost the game to North Carolina State in Albuquerque. And so that's what I tried to communicate to players all the way through. And it got tougher and tougher because if you hear when 865 kids transfer every year, the first thing they say is, hey, I've got to do what's best for me and my family and what I feel. And in reality, I've always felt like the most important thing is what's best for your team. And if you play it that way, that success of your team will guide you, in the future like it did for me.
So I'm curious what happened with transfers at BYU, because there was an era when multiple teams, but certainly football and men's basketball, didn't get many, if any, transfers or grad transfers in. And now it seems like things have really loosened up. We've seen it both in football and men's basketball, and it seems to be working. What changed? Who changed it? How did it happen?
Well, I think the best guy to ask that question to is probably Tom, because Tom went through a period where he kind of discouraged his coaches from actually going out there because there wasn't really a place to put them. I mean, you just take this for example. At one time, that the last application to a graduate department deadline, as far as the date was concerned, was like February 25th. So if you didn't have your application into the graduate school by February 25th, you couldn't get a kid enrolled into the program. Well, February 25th, the basketball season is not even over yet, and the grad transfers haven't even put their names out there as far as being able to be eligible to be recruited. And so, obviously, that rule has softened a little bit because now not only the football team, but the basketball team is involved with grad transfers. I had one in my career, and it was the son of one of my former teammates who I was best friends with. And, if we ever tried to document how that happened and how many times he was told that it wasn't going to happen and how many times I told his dad, hey, just hang in there. We're going to try and get this done. If I was recruiting the kid, and he would have left a long time ago, but since his dad really wanted him to play for me, it worked for us, and LJ was a really good player for us till he got hurt. But I think that the philosophy of the athletic department, they just realized that that is a huge part of today's recruiting. I mean, that transfer portal is absolutely essential to the ability to be able to put your team together late after things have happened. If you got guys that are transferring and leaving you because of whatever reason, you got to be able to replace that somehow and be able to go and grab a guy here or grab a guy there. I think the athletic department has done a great job with the administration of the university to be able to find a way to start getting these guys in there.
I'm wondering if you see any danger in this path to go down, because it's sort of like with the freshmen and the one and dones. If you start going heavy on that, then you're basically committing to go into that almost to the point of every year. Like the same thing if you recruit these one and dones like Sean Miller has been doing, and so they're not getting the team success because these guys are coming in there, they're not necessarily ready and mature, and then they take off. The other side, they are maybe ready and mature, but if you're going to invest a lot of time in them, they're only going to be there for 1 year. So you see any problems going down that road too much?
Well, it's so hard because it's such a delicate balance. I don't think that in BYU's situation, I don't think there's any way that you can make that your top priority as far as that's what you're going to build your program around is signing one-year guys. You know, the fact that you've always got to have freshmen, the best, especially the best LDS freshmen around the country. You got to find them and bring them in and then kind of massage them and mold them until they're ready to help you play, and hopefully they're still around by then. But I do know that there's buddies of mine, in the business that are getting 2, 3, 4 a year, and that puts a ton of pressure on them to do the same thing the next year, after they're gone. And it kind of reminds me of the 10 years that I was in junior college. When I was in junior college at Dixie, and we were, trying to get, players every single year to replace either a sophomore that was leaving or a freshman that had qualified and he was leaving. And so way more similar to the recruiting approach and also the approach of your team. And we used to put these teams together in junior college for 8 months. I mean, that's what you did. You just realized that, hey, let's get the best players we can possibly find, put that team together, and then let that team go, and then put another team together. And it worked for us in junior college, but I think in a four-year school, you just really have to have the core of those good freshmen and then mix in the junior college every once in a while, and now these graduate transfers. And the actual, we made a pretty good living at BYU off of the transfers that sat a year for us. Eli Bryant sat a year, and Chase Fisher sat a year, was a pretty good player for us. And, we had some pretty good guys. Kyle Davis over the years, Matt Carlino. So, we made a pretty good living off of having a kid, bringing him in, sit a year, and work out with our guys and get used to it and then be ready to play, from that experience.
Dave Rose, former BYU basketball head coach, joining us. The NBA has expanded rosters from 12 to 15. Now they've added 16th and 17th spots with these two-way contracts where guys can make $175,000. Now there's this G League project. Has the NBA set the bar financially at a place where elite players, and there's no nice way to say this, where elite players are going to make more money in the NBA or the G League than they can make in whatever the under-the-table economy is in college basketball? Because the FBI transcripts have, you know, laid bare some of the stuff and some of the numbers and all that. But I see these multimillion-dollar programs and multimillion-dollar coaching jobs, and I wonder how much it's worth to people to keep their jobs to make sure that whether it comes from a school, a booster, a shoe company, or whoever, that some money gets funneled these guys' way. And it almost... You know, there's money in all things, and it seems like a race just continues to heat up for cash over these top young players.
You know, I think that, you know, obviously these kids, every one of them, and we're talking about maybe 10 or 15 kids a year, the really high elite guys that everybody's after, that people know that are, you know, only going to play college for a year. You know, we've had these few kids that have taken the money overseas and gone and played, you know, in Australia or in Europe. And I think the NBA is tired of chasing those guys all over the country to see how good they really are and where they fit in the next draft. And so what they want to do is keep them close. And so what they've done is kind of anteed up. And now they've got some of these kids playing here for $500,000 or so, but they're going to be, you know, right here in the States, and everybody will have a chance to see him a lot easier. I think that will influence not a majority of kids, but the majority of that elite group of kids. It'll start to influence those guys because it's hard to make that money up. I mean, you miss a year or two of that $500,000 or that million, and then, you know, you really won't make that money up until your second contract, if you really make it, you know, to there. And so, and that kind of money, I mean, obviously $50,000, $100,000 is a lot of money to, you know, a kid coming out of high school, but a $500,000 is, you know, a number that these kids will put a lot of pressure on them to go grab early to help them, their families, and anybody else who has helped them along the way.
We've seen, obviously, finances are a big concern now with this, the world that we're living in, and sports are being dropped and all, and there's been all sorts of different ways to recruit. Do you see these things being beneficial to the game and maybe easing some of the pressure of being out on the road for months at a time or weeks at a time?
You know, that's a good question. I feel for, you know, a young assistant coach in the business right now, because it's really up in the air on how it's going to go. I mean, I think the established head coaches, you got to be patient and just see the direction that it's going to go, and then you adjust and adapt to it. But I would have never thought. I mean, I can tell you this, guys, that, you know, I coached for 36 years at the high school level, the junior college level, the Division I level, and as a head coach and an assistant coach at all three levels. And I never went to work one day wondering if we were going to play games. I mean, I always knew that was happening. Here comes the schedule, and the 1st of November, the middle of November, you know, we're going to start, and this is what's going to happen. I mean, these kids now, they're and, you know, and the coaches, they're in a really unique situation where they don't really know for sure if, you know, when their games are going to start and if their games are going to start and how their games are going to start. And that would be a really interesting off season to be a coach, is trying to get your guys motivated. I know that the NCAA passed the rule that you don't have to be in school this summer to actually work out at the university, but you got to get these universities open to where the athletes can actually come to the back to the school. They don't have to be in class, and they don't have to be enrolled like normally, but they have to be able to use the facilities that have been opened by the officials. And that's, that's a challenge, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
How are they going to evaluate a whole class of high school stars without a normal summer AAU schedule?
Man, I have a friend of mine who's got a son that's going to be a senior next year. And what, I mean, you start, you know, pinpointing groups of people that how disappointed you are for it. It never stops. You know, high school seniors that didn't get their graduation or didn't get their prom, or it's just who would have ever imagined that this would be where we're at, and not just in sports, but in any part of you know, life. I mean, just going to the grocery store, and you know, I'm trying to figure out. It just intrigues me that as the states start to open up again, that who wears a mask and who doesn't wear a mask, and how political it's become. And you know, for me, a 62-year-old guy that's got, you know, blood sugar issues, it's got heart issues, and got, you know, has battled cancer for 11 years. You know, the mask means something completely different to me than it means to, you know, an 18-year-old kid coming out of high school. But I do believe that what we've been through and how this has all happened, that the respect for those who have lost their lives, the respect for those who are battling this thing with the healthcare workers, that it makes me really think about what I can do to try to help with this thing. But it's affected this whole world in a way that I'd have never imagined.
You think now that he's 50, Tim Lacombe is finally going to grow up?
No, that'll never happen. We, you know, we had his a kind of a dumbed down COVID-19 birthday party the other night, and but we're still waiting for the big night, and that's when he brings his high school band out here, and we have the big concert at Valor, and that's been postponed, but that will happen, and I think that's the night that we'll actually be able to you know, see the change. He'll be a rock star for a night, and then he'll after the next morning he'll wake up and realize, hey, it's time to get to work.
Nice.
And for people who don't know, there's a whole John Bon Jovi side to his personality that people have no idea.
And he is really talented, I'm telling you. I mean, I went and listened to his band back in Dallas one night when they played at a high school reunion. And, I mean, he was up there for 2.5 hours, probably sang 60 different songs, knew the lyrics to every one of them, and had a costume change 2 different times. I mean, he was John Bon Jovi for a night that night.
Costume change? What did he share?
Yeah. I mean, he had jackets. I mean, it's in Dallas, Texas. It's 95 degrees and 88% humidity, and he's wearing sweatshirts and jackets and T-shirts, and he sweat through one. He had to take the other one off. It was good. It was good stuff.
Dave, as always, we appreciate a few minutes. Thanks for coming on.
All right, guys. Good luck to you. Are you guys together or are you split up?
Split up.
Oh, yeah, still split, huh?
Yep. PK's broadcasting.
You got a date when you're coming back together in the studio?
No, not yet. It's kind of open-ended right now. So.
That's the one thing I've tried to get used to, is trying to communicate on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know when to talk and when not to talk. And when to, so I've found that the best thing to do is just listen most of the time.
There you go. There you go. Hey, Dave, thanks for a few minutes. We appreciate it.
All right. See you guys.